having been asked to do this segment on servant leadership, I don't think the leadership knew when they asked me, but it is a model that I've embraced for decades, and to many it's kind of exciting. I don't know half the crowd, so that's new. I hadn't been here for a while. To give you a bit of my background and where I come from, I'm kind of a unique model in that oftentimes individuals come in as faculty, they go through the tenure process, then they become administration. I've gone the opposite direction in that I spent 27 years here at Clemson in, as a staff member and then in administration in the College of Ag, Forest, and Life Sciences. And my role and position then was to serve the Agricultural Academy here at Clemson. So I did academic recruiting, alumni services, career services, advising, new faculty orientation. I mean, everything that could be done within our college, I did. And so, and I started as one individual, one professional staff. We now have a group we call the Circle of Life that manages everything from potential students to major donors. Mm-hmm. So we're serving that entire circle to support the mission of Clemson University. So this idea of servant leadership was introduced to me years ago through a variety of individuals. And so when I was asked to do this, I'd never had a chance to study it from a point of scholarship and actually doing some literature review and things like that. So it's been very intriguing for me. And that my introduction to it was kind of through popular culture aspects. And I did do some learning on it at that point in time because I'd been blessed. How many of you here know who Ken Blanchard is? The one-minute manager. Ever heard of him? For us older folks, we may know who he is, but Ken Blanchard was a professor at Cornell who studied in ag economics at Cornell. For those that don't know, Cornell is a unique hybrid land grant in that part of the school is a private Ivy League, the other part is land grant, and so the College of Business's ag department is larger than their entire school of business because it's about 80% cheaper to go to the ag college than it is to go to the business school at Cornell. So it's very unique in that aspect. But Ken was a farm boy and went to Cornell and studied ag econ and became a true kind of popular culture management guru in the late 70s, early 80s, early 90s, and still living today. But I've had the opportunity to meet him and know him through the ag econ program at Cornell. And he is one who probably injected servant leadership into popular culture significantly. So we'll look at that in a little bit. But how many of you are, beyond just kind of hearing the phrase servant leadership, feel like you have an understanding of the model and the theory and the background in it? Anybody in the room? Carissa does. Carl does. Mary. So it's a... it's a very intriguing model. It's a fairly young model that kind of came out in the 60s and 70s. But to give you an idea, a little bit about the roots of servant leadership. So the roots actually come from where it was enunciated and built by a gentleman by the name of Robert K. Greenleaf, and he wrote a paper called Servant as a Leader. Now, the intriguing thing is that he was an individual who started at the very bottom with AT&T basically as a technician, and worked his way up through the entire AT&T system. At that point in time, in the 50s, 60s, AT&T literally was the largest international company in the world. And he was a farm boy and was just very mechanically oriented. And so the reality of his ability to work with as a technician got his foot in the door. But where he went to school, many of his teachers and managers often stated that they did not feel like organizations were treating their employees well, they were serving society. So he kind of entered this corporate world, AT&T, with a view that there was something he could do to make it better. And so as he entered into this, at that point in time, the model from 19th and early 20th century models of leadership with the idea that, you know, leaders were kind of born, you know, we came from this concept of the hierarchical model from, you know, Britain to the U.S., and then with the Industrial Revolution, you had the industrial magnates of the late 1800s, early 1900s, and so succession of family were the leaders in the large, big companies. You know, during that time period, if you think about it, we didn't have all this entrepreneurial and startups and those kind of things. Basically, it moved through large family lines at that time, and so But there was also the view that good management made for successful organizations. That's where you have the classic stereotype of when the son comes in and doesn't have the work ethic of the father. You see many classic novels written from that standpoint, or the unfairness of that aspect. But then also, there was also a risk avoidance or fear because of power, but also things weren't as progressive and everything kind of was held within the family or in the lineage. And so this idea of helping your employees or others grow really wasn't a part of the American culture as we know it today within companies. It truly still lived by this. And so Greenleaf entered into the world of leadership or corporate America with that idea, and he said it does not have to be this way. The other interesting thing to him is he came to faith in his middle age. Was a Quaker through the Quaker aspect, and so he truly embraced Judeo-Christian principle as an adult. And that, you know, as he tells his story, that really kind of altered his view of things, and he started thinking about this particular model. And thus, right now there's a great place called the Center for Servant Leadership that is done in his name and his honor, which has academies and training and different assessment tools and things like that that actually continues to go on to this day. He has passed away, but there's an advisory board, a board of trustees that continues to take this model and move it forward in the world today. So what does this model look like? Well, it's the idea that leaders are identified by what they do. And you've often experienced this. You probably never realize it, but there's times where groups come together and there's not necessarily an appointed leader, but all of a sudden a leader kind of develops out of it. And sometimes it's people that are doing the most. I mean, you know, if you know the history of Faculty Commons at Clemson, you know, Melissa Sternhagen and Carl Baum have been the servant leaders of this organization. And then we had John come in a formal fashion. But here on this campus, all that Melissa and Carl did when we were a fledgling organization to get the flames going is a true example of servant leadership to us. You know, and then Bill, the history of it, Bill wasn't here in the beginning, as I recall. So Bill came along and it formalized somebody. Number one, I'm going to talk to you about competing commitments. Bill came along and once he was retired, didn't have all the competing commitments. And so he stepped in and it felt like we had a formal faculty leader in addition to a staff person. And so it's interesting in that in our organization, we've had our leaders grow up. But the interesting principle about servant leadership that Greenleaf put forth is that identified people become the first among equals, or the primus inter pares. My Latin isn't real good, whether that's Greek. But that first among equals, do y'all know another organization where that is a term that's used or known and recognized? Within the church, among elders within church, there's oftentimes there's a greater among equals. And so that principle that he put forth came, this is the idea that leaders actually grow out of organizations, but a servant leader doesn't look to be the person at the top or be identified or have the flag or the sticker that says I'm the leader. They see themselves as an equal with everybody else. And for Greenleaf, a lot of his realities came out of this little book he read called The Journey, which kind of gave this example of how this happened with a band of men that were moving along. And the one that was the servant of all actually was the one that kind of funded the trip and led it along, but they didn't know that. And so when he exited, the whole group fell apart. And so servant leadership also, and this is where it means so much to the academy, is that servant leadership is about teaching and mentoring as one of the major requirements to invite others to serve. So that leading by example is so very important when it comes to being a servant leader, in that you want to make certain that as those you're mentoring, or to use a Christian term, discipling, that they see in your life an authenticity, an integrity that they would want to follow and exemplify. Now, this is something that's important. When people hear the term servant or servile leadership, they automatically think some things such as, you know, important thing to realize, it is not weakness. A servant leader is not somebody who's weak. You're not subject to the desires of your followers. It's like, you know, oh, whatever you say, whatever you want to do, I'll do it. You know, it's not that you go, students, would y'all like a test tomorrow? And they go, no, we don't want a test. And so you say, well, I'm a servant, so I'm not going to give you this. So it's not that at all. It's also not naive. A lot of people think servant leaders are kind of like this milquetoast and think, oh, everybody's wonderful. We can trust everybody. They'll do what they say. They'll follow through. You know, I don't have to have grading in my class. They all deserve it. It's not that at all, but lots of times people kind of think that it's a, you know, they believe everybody's good. It's also not trusting others blindly. You know, you believe the best as a servant leader, but you know, it's show me the money, you know, as Jerry Maguire. You've got to do that, and you know, you exemplify that in your own life. You show that you're doing the work and you expect others to do the work, but many times people think that being a servant leader is you're just kind of whatever it's wanted. And it's not just for Christians. That was something that Greenleaf oftentimes talked about, that it is for all individuals, secular and Judeo-Christian, and for ones of other faith. So he would oftentimes, because of his Quaker identity and his Christian faith, he was oftentimes, you know, kind of categorized as this is a Jesus leadership model. But he would say he did not believe that at all. And then, and it is not a simple model to employ. In fact, compared to other leadership models, like an autocratic leadership model, it is very interesting. And when you look at the principles, so many of the principles, and we're going to look at here, you know, the characteristics, they're intangibles. They're what's happening inside. So it's not that kind of top-down behavior. It's not that external skills you can learn. It's really what's happening in the heart, which makes it a model that in some ways hasn't been, it's hard for postmodern individuals, organizations to embrace it at times because of that. So what have been identified, and these 10 characteristics have come from a number of scholars. All of my references are at the end of the presentation, but these seem to be kind of the key characteristics of servant leadership. And if you'll notice, it starts with a hierarchy from kind of internal to external, internal action to external impact. So a servant leader is first a listener. And it's not just listening to others, it's listening to the self. Or as Greenleaf would say, you know, he believes we have a dialogue with God. And in a certain place he would refer to, as you understand what the higher power is, or that inner voice. I call it a Christian Jesus. And so, you know, but it's this aspect of listening to yourself, listening to others, listening to everything around you, to gather, to understand. This is a very active, intuitive type listening. Then number two, it's empathy, understanding those around you, understanding what's happening, and recognizing empathy goes beyond that aspect of sympathy. Empathy is really seeking to understand and put yourself in that person's place. And it really takes time to do that. Number three is one I love. It's about healing. And this is much about healing for yourself. And this is one Greenleaf did a lot of writing on because of what, you know, in his life, having come to Christ as in the middle age. There was just much that he learned and saw in that aspect. But part of it, too, is the healing is leading to wholeness. And because servant leadership is a model of mentoring and demonstration, seeking that healing. For me, I mentioned about the cereal and obesity. You know, since I was 5 or 6 years old, I have struggled with my weight in a classic obesity, American obesity story. But I've never given up, and at age 24, started seeking to address it from a spiritual standpoint. And I continue to seek to address it to this very day, claiming the scripture of do not grow weary in doing good, for in due time you'll reap a harvest. Because, you know, when you're obese, the minute someone sees you, they can literally point to behavior or character flaws in your life because of that. They don't know your story, but it's one of those sins. If we were to label it biblically, lethargy and gluttony and those and all those ways, but then you get into biochemistry and all that, if you go to science, it can easily be labeled. So to demonstrate leadership, and I don't desire for anyone else to struggle with obesity because I know what it's like. So as a servant leader, my goal has always been to be battling that. I mean, one of the ways I've done it, even though I have not obtained victory forever, My physical's in 2 weeks, and my doctor's always amazed because I've always sought to try to eat healthy. I move and exercise all the time. I don't have all the comorbidities that go with obesity. My whole PhD is on leisure and obesity. And so, you know, when I did the chance to talk to ones who struggle with their weight, like our Weight Watchers group there on campus, you know, I'm constantly preaching that because you're obese, you do not have to be damned to poor health. And many people just want to give up with that whole aspect. But there's a whole lot of research on fit and fat now. And so that's a prime example in my life of where I've sought to serve and lead in that area, even though I know it's real. And the fact that I have dealt with the shame and I can talk about it and be open about it and recognize that it does not impact who I am in Christ or who I am as a person, that's part of the whole healing process too that occurred about 20 years ago in my life. So, you know, somebody like John, who's known me since college, has known I've struggled with it my whole life, and it's been something I've shared and been accountable about and things like that. So healing is a very interesting point that for many people, when they see something like that, they're like, whoa, 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 what in the world does that have to do with leadership? But if we think what was one of Christ's missions he came for was to bring healing for all. So then number four goes very close to that. It's about awareness, and this is as much about self-awareness as it is awareness of those you lead. The power of persuasion is part of it because, and this isn't a persuasion with fear or power or demanding. This is that sweet, gentle persuasion that those of us, when we came to Christ, we recognized that it was often his kindness that led us to repentance. And so that's part of this. Conceptualization is this idea that servant leaders almost can have this innate ability to see and sense what is happening around them or with other individuals in their lives, and this ability to put forth a vision. I like to think of it as a true manifestation of hope, faith, and love in people's lives. Because one of the things we possess as believers that non-believers do not possess is a hope and a faith that things can be different. We're not defeated. And so as servant leaders, I think we really can grab hold of that because of the truth of scriptures. And that goes along well with foresight, this sense that a servant leader knows themselves, knows those they're leading, and get a sense if we do A, B is potentially going to occur, which hopefully will lead to C, or we could get another path. And so that foresight, they know themselves well enough, they know others, they're seeking to kind of know what action's going to occur when things happen. And they're cognizant of that. They don't just say, well, I'm going to make this decision, I don't care what happens. That's where something like empathy flows into this. And all of these are very much interrelated as you move through the process. And so it's a constant moving target. Stewardship is this idea that my actions have consequences. They have cost. They have returns on investment. So I am constantly, first and foremost, accountable to God, accountable to myself, and accountable to those I serve. And so this helps to prevent from you making decisions in a vacuum. You know, we here at a large institution like Clemson, oftentimes you'll see a decision come over email, and your first thought will be, who in the world did they talk to about that decision? And, you know, right now, the whole student organization, oh my gosh, it's in an uproar because of some of that kind of stuff. And the amount of time and energy and things having to go back because, you know, they didn't ask the question, who else needs to know? I mean, it's so convoluted, I can't even go there, but that's an example that's just happening right now at Clemson, is that you weren't thinking about, now, what will be the consequences of this decision going forward. Number nine is a commitment to the growth of others, and I think as faculty members in an institution, that should be the hallmark of what leads us. And that others piece is oftentimes what can cause some to struggle, but as teachers, we can build others with the knowledge and skills we teach, with the example we are, with the nurturing. I especially think with graduate students, there's so much we have to offer, which is going to be one of the questions I put forward to us in a minute. And lastly, all this leads to the concept of building community. And this is building small communities, large communities, and kind of the concentric circles idea of, you know, you start right in your core, and as you impact others, that can spread wider and wider and wider. So the multiplication principle flows into this idea of community. So as we learn to lead ourselves, we can apply that to others as we serve them, which then moves us forward. So anybody have any thoughts or comments as you look at those 10?
So would healing be like a person would first focus on their like own personal healing from maybe consequences of sin and then be concerned with others? Or, I mean, some of these
that is one,
both the person and their recipients or the people.
It's a couple of things. It can be, it's individual healing, healing of conflict within an organization, you know, being
reconciled.
Blessed are the peacemakers, ministry of reconciliation. So that's one way it happens. Another thing Greenlee points to, it's oftentimes it is amazing how healing information can be. So education, in a sense. So one of his tenets was that many times organizations are unaware of the damage they're causing. And if we can inform leaders and they understand, they're like, oh, I did not realize that was happening. And so that's part of the healing process. So he really does look at it as a holistic picture. But it is an odd word to see within a leadership model, if you think about it. But when we understand this is based on Christ, it's very clear.
Yeah, Ad, it's not only based on Christ, but it's exemplified in the early church.
Yeah.
So when you look at elders in the early church, they are identified. It's not like you go to elder school and get handed an elder degree and go off and be an elder.
Yeah.
It's Paul and these other people looking around and saying, who's already doing the work? Who's being a mini elder already?
Yeah.
And then those people are identified and formally named as elders.
Yes, and they're raised up, so this idea that they grow, they identify themselves. Very much so. And now, just to look at it in a... Perlini kind of wanted to put it in a format or context. So he is one that followed up on a lot of Greenleaf's writings and studies. I mean, literally, Greenleaf has books and articles and all kind of context that he wrote in. But he saw this, he put it in this one kind of long, drawn-out sentence. But you see it's kind of broken into a three-part process. So it's this idea that you as an individual bring integrity, humility, and servanthood into, and this is where it moves to others, caring for, empowering, and developing others, then into the organization to carry out tasks and processes of visioning, goal setting, leading, modeling, team building, and shared decision making. So he took this kind of more ethereal work that Greenleaf did and started applying it to what does that look like in a formal organization, if I was to actually do this. And so he's one of the scholars that kind of took it and led it on. And so then after it kind of got this place, it started oozing into the popular culture through two avenues most strongly. One was Ken Blanchard, who wrote several books on Leadership by the Book, Lead Like Jesus, and then he and Truett Cathy, he thought Truett Cathy was the ultimate servant leader. Truett Cathy's the founder of Chick-fil-A. So he wrote this great book in parable form called The Generosity Factor. One of the favorite books I have read out of all time. Very easy reading. But the person or the parable is about a guy who basically sells auto parts. It doesn't sell chicken. But you ultimately see within... Within the story about a servant leader, and he just gives constant examples of what it's like to be a servant leader. Oh, did it? Y'all almost died on me.
I think you disconnected the VGA.
Oh, I did. I just disconnected the wrong one. Duh. And I'm sure many of you have heard of John Maxwell. He also embraced. He doesn't necessarily call it servant leadership, but through many of his books, he integrates principles of servant leadership into a lot of his writing. And so these are some of the popular culture books that kind of brought it into the vernacular. And Leadership by the Book, Lead Like Jesus, and The Generosity Factor are all written in parable format in the way that Jesus taught. So it's very interesting way. And so that they kind of built on research that has continued. And that my first introduction was Leadership by the Book to Servant Leadership. Now, where do we see it in Scripture? Well, there's quite a few places in Isaiah 53, the suffering servant. Literally, we see within these verses many of those 10 principles that we saw, and that through the example of Christ, he was someone who was seeking to live for others. There wasn't anything, you know, there wasn't this huge charisma or power structure. You know, the Jews were looking for somebody that would look like a powerful king. He came in a cradle. So Christ himself does represent many of those unique principles just in his personage. And the idea that here he was God and came to earth as a man, which we also see defined in Philippians 2:5, that, you know, though he was God, he humbled himself. And humility is one of the key hallmarks of servant leadership. And he became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So he gave the ultimate sacrifice. And then, of course, now he is lifted up and is over all. And so, you know, every knee will bow. You know, so that ultimate servanthood has put Christ at the place of preeminence, which therefore he is truly our most powerful example. A couple other key verses I think that are representing what Christ stated was that the questions of the disciples about who shall be first, and Christ's response was, you know, the last shall be first. You know, when you're serving the least of these, you're serving me. And so these verses demonstrate this idea that there's a paradox in servant leadership, and that when we think of leaders and power, especially in the Western world, we often are thinking of the one that is the most visible, the one with the most power, the one that's ahead. Christ turns it upside down, and the pyramid looks very different. So the least, the one who's the servant of all, is the one that is the true leader. So, as you know, you think about this in the academy, you know, I think, what are some of these challenges? So first question is, how do we mitigate the competing commitments to succeed in the academy with servant leadership principles? So when, you know, the reality of how the tenure track works, you know, the recognition of we're always competing for limited resources in an institution, it creates a competing commitment in a sense. The whole concept of how can peer review be informed by servant leadership? In some ways, peer review almost sets up from a competing standpoint, but, you know, when I see some comments that come back on submitted articles and stuff, you know, I think that is not a building way to say that at all. You know, it's just like, I'm going to tear you down. Or when you go to conferences sometime and everybody knows these two faculty members are basically competing for acceptance of their thought or their idea or their theory, you can watch these camps happening. And so it's a, you know, that becomes a challenge in the academy. And then, you know, how should we as faculty view staff? You know, there's no doubt when you read documents, when you see budgets, when you see structures, there is a hierarchy in the academy. You know, there's even a hierarchy that is interesting now, and that, you know, being tier one now, which is more valuable, research or teaching? You know, how do our departments handle that? How do we speak into that from where our roles are? And then how do we balance professional demands with availability to people in service? And those people are many times our family members. You know, I often said when I was getting my PhD, my wife was a comps widow and a dissertation widow for quite a season just to get that done. Now, I was working full-time myself, but still, you know, the reality that to succeed, oftentimes there have to be sacrifices. And so as a servant leader, managing those hidden commitments or competing commitments can be a challenge. So for the sake of discussion, I have some questions here for us to consider. So, what is your view and understanding of servant leadership and its relevance to the academy? Anybody have a thought to speak to that?